Welcome to the Political Cesspool, known worldwide as the South's foremost populist radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
Everybody, welcome back to the third and final hour of the Political Cesspool radio program. My rousing rendition of Dixie there being played as we kick off the last hour of tonight's show, Saturday, April 17th. And I'm your host, of course, James Edwards, still with me for the final hour of tonight's show, Bill Rowland, as we co-host together and bring you this award-winning program from the confines of AM 1380 WLRM Studios in Memphis, Tennessee, going out around the world on the internet at thepoliticalcesspool.org and libertynewsradio.com, and to also the AM/FM affiliate stations of the Liberty News Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in with us. I hope you have enjoyed tonight's show. Last week, I was talking, Bill, with Sam Dixon, of course, a mutual friend of ours. You and Sam had a real good time in Florence, Alabama last time. You know, that's a story for another show. But I was talking to Sam about Dixie, and every time I hear Dixie, I've heard it thousands of times, and every time I hear Dixie, I am here to tell you that there will be at least a few goosebumps, if not the entire body. And that show with Sam Dixon, by the way, was perhaps, I thought, the best show of the year until this one. Bill Rowland has found a way to trump it. But, Bill, what is it you think about our songs and hearing stories of our heroes that brings out that physical emotion, the eyes swelling, skin chilling? What do you think it is?
James, I tell you, I love Dixie, but I actually prefer the Bonnie Blue Flag. Actually, the Bonnie Blue Flag was more of a patriotic song in the South During the war, because it really speaks about Southern secession. It's less sentimental and really more direct. I got some trivia for you. Of course, some of it's well known, and some of it's probably already, much of our well-educated, intelligent listening audience already knows. Of course, Dixie was written by a Northerner named Daniel Emmett, and he actually regretted writing the song because it was used by the South. But, of course, the Star Spangled Banner was written by a Southerner, Francis Scott Key, whose descendants and relatives fought for the Confederacy during the war. So, you know, there's a little reversal of roles there. Also, the highest-ranking Confederate general, technically, during the war, was Samuel Cooper. It was not Robert E. Lee. Technically, it was Samuel Cooper by seniority. Samuel Cooper was from New York. The highest-ranking general, technically, in the Northern Army was Winfield Scott, who was from Virginia. Okay. So, you know, there was a little cultural crossover, a little border crossing as far as our generals are concerned. It might interest our listeners to know that Winston Churchill, no less a personage than Winston Churchill, considered Stonewall Jackson's Stonewall Brigade, his body of infantry, to be the finest body of infantry that ever took a battlefield. He considered them what they were called the foot cavalry, because they marched so fast, to be the best infantry unit ever created. That's Winston Churchill said that in his memoir. Another interesting fact, and this one a little less well known, there was a lady, one of the most famous ladies, actually, in the United States. Very few people know her name, but nevertheless, she is one of the most famous women of all time. She, during the war, was from North Carolina, I believe, originally from North Carolina, and she actually smuggled medicines to Confederate hospitals from the North and acted as a spy also, and was even threatened numerous times with arrest, almost got caught. Her son was a physician in the Confederate Army, a surgeon, and she repeatedly made smuggling trips back and forth from north to south to bring medicines to Confederate hospitals and also to supply information, you know, that might be valuable to the Confederacy. Later on, she would, I think, move to France, where her other son was studying art, and his name was James Whistler. And the lady in the painting of Whistler's mother, the painting, was actually a Confederate spy, a Confederate supplier of medicines, and an absolute Confederate patriot. So this lady in this picture, when you see Whistler's mother, arguably the most famous American painting of all time, was a Confederate lady. So there, the Confederacy really goes all through American history, even after the war. Numerous people that you know little about now were connected with the Confederacy, no less than Theodore Roosevelt's mother was a Confederate, the daughter of a Confederate diplomat. Bullock was her name, and her father was a high-ranking Confederate official, and he had always had sympathetic views of the Confederacy because of his mother. Douglas MacArthur's mother was a Confederate. His father was a Yankee general, but his mother was a Confederate. So, you know, you can't separate the Confederacy from really the spectrum of American history.
Bill, that is...
And so to shame all of the Confederacy for what we did is to shame these other people who had connections with the Confederacy who honored it.
So, Bill, that is...
You know, when these idiots
excellent.
And morons and ignoramuses start attacking the Confederacy, they're also attacking, you know, laterally and in another direction, people like Winston Churchill, Theodore Roosevelt, James Whistler, and others who had real intimate connections with the Confederacy. So, you know, I think that needs to be... Oh, and another one, very little known, was Nancy Astor, the first female member of British Parliament, was the daughter of a Confederate. So, you know, Lady Nancy Astor. So, you know, there's no escaping the Confederacy throughout American history, in fact, throughout world history. And to do so is really a shame on our intelligence and on our respect for our heroes.
Bill, that is great trivia. Again, material you're only going to get on this radio program. We promised the audience that they would be allowed to call in and that we would graciously take a few calls. And we are men of our word, so we're going to do that. We have Dr. Michael Hill on, president of the League of the South. We're going to get to him at the top of the next segment, which is just a minute or two away. But before that, let's try to work in a quick call, Bill. Let's go to Idaho, where we have Wes on the line. Wes from Idaho, you're on the political cesspool. What can we do for you tonight?
Yes, James. Do you know the origin of the word racist?
Denny, can you pipe up my volume on the callers a little bit? All right, repeat that one more time, Wes. I apologize.
Do you know the origin of the word racist?
Bill, do you know the origin of the word racist?
I do. Yes, I do. It goes back at least to 1928 and to, I believe it was originated, well, first, it was used once, I know, by a Jewish communist named Israel Marx, used in an article, and originally it was used in French, in a French translation by the Menshevik, Trotsky, Leon Trotsky, coined the term in terms of, you know, race as a factor in the development of communism. In fact, Trotsky had advocated that the proletariat was no longer good enough to carry on the revolution, and it needed to be run and basically managed and commanded by blacks and other non-whites. This is back in the 20s.
Yeah.
Wes, am I right on that? Do I get 10 points?
Did Bill win the prize, Wes?
Yes. I get here that it comes from the English Oxford Dictionary, that it was, yes, Leon Davidovich Bronstein or Leon Trotsky. The first time it was used was 1930 in his work, the history of the Russian Revolution, from which shown above is a passage, I'm actually reading here off the page. The last word in the passage is Poktob, which Latin transliteration is race dov, i.e. racist. This work is the first time...
Wes, hold that thought, my friend. Hold that thought. We got to take a break. We're going to come back with Dr. Michael Hill and more calls right after this.
Don't go away. There's more Political Cesspool coming your way right after these messages. Welcome back. To get on the Political Cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the Political Cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, the phone lines are burning up. I promise we're going to try to take as many calls as we can throughout the remainder of this hour. So keep trying to get through if you have not already been put in the queue. The number is 1-866-986-NEWS, and we appreciate the flood of support that's coming in, all these callers from all over the country. But first, Bill Rowland and I would like to welcome back to the radio program Dr. Michael Hill, president of the League of the South. Dr. Michael Hill has been on this radio show numerous times throughout our six-plus years of history. He always makes appearances in April. And as a matter of fact, Dr. Hill, I'm holding in my hand right now a magazine that is inappropriately titled The Intelligence Report. It's from the Southern Poverty Law Center, Fall 2007, Issue 127. There's a, I don't know, six, seven-page spread bashing me in this magazine. And there's three pictures here in the caption. It says, Radicals on the Radio. And out of all the people we've ever had on this show, they picked three people to feature in this article here. And it says, among the guests on the Political Cesspool have been Gordon Baum of the Council of Conservative Citizens, Paul Fromm, and Michael Hill, leader of the League of the South. So welcome home, Dr. Hill.
Well, I am proud and honored to know that.
You look good. You look real stately.
I'm in good company with you and Bill Rowland.
As always, and certainly we appreciate and enjoy your company. And you did a good picture of you, though. You look real stately. Got a nice suit on. Got the First National flag behind you. Looks like you're on a Capitol stairway somewhere. So they didn't do you a disservice there. But it is good to have you back, I tell you.
Well, it's good to be here. I'm just glad they didn't put one of me when I had my overalls on working in the garden.
No, they didn't do that, but maybe next time.
Maybe.
Well, anyway, Dr. Hill, as we said, we always have you on in April for a number of reasons. Number one, because you're certainly on the front lines of defending Confederate history. You're the leader of an organization whose sole mission is such. Tell us a little bit more about the League of the South, because it's a membership organization. We certainly think that our listenership should check into. So first of all, before we go anywhere, let's plug the League.
Well, we've been around for almost 16 years, and we're a Southern nationalist organization. We believe that there ought to be a free and independent Southern Republic, and if we had one, we could get rid of a lot of our problems that emanate from Washington. So we have several thousand members, and we try to do something every day to not only defend but advance the cause of the South. So we're a membership organization, as you said. We got a website. We certainly would be interested in having some of your listeners check us out.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you go to our homepage, thepoliticalcesspool.org, you will find there, I think it's two or three articles down on the blog roll, an absolutely incredible article written by Michael Hill, our guest this evening, entitled Why My Heart's in Dixie. You'll want to read that to learn more about the man we're having on tonight. And after you've read that, you'll certainly want to check out the website for the League of the South. It's linked there prominently on our website. I know you know our website. You can link to it from there, or you can go there directly. It's dixienet.org, D-I-X-I-E-N-E-T.org, dixienet.org. That's the homepage for the League of the South. Read more about the League, learn more about Michael Hill, then join up as a member of the League of the South, and you'll be certainly doing your part to save the South. Bill, turn it over to you. We're going to get back to some calls. And when we take calls, we'll give Dr. Hill first dibs on answering some of the questions. But before we go back to the phones, Bill, certainly want to afford you the opportunity to say hello to our friend, maybe ask a question or two.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Michael. It's good to see you.
Hey, Bill. Good to hear, your voice.
Let me ask you a question. People like me and James and us unreconstructed post-war Confederates, of course, dream of an independent South. But in a practical matter, obviously, there are some difficult obstacles to that, considering, for instance, one being demographics. The fact is that virtually every major city in the South now, except for Nashville, I think Little Rock, Knoxville, and now New Orleans, have black mayors and large black populations, which are not sympathetic to this idea. Do you have a plan or a strategy for overcoming that demographic, obstacle to what would be possible Southern nationhood?
Well, Bill, that's a good question and certainly a problem that that needs to be considered. You know, all those cities, even though they're in enemy hands, do lie within the sovereign states. And for example, if a state, Tennessee, Alabama, went out, you would have Memphis or Birmingham, that would certainly be as you described. But those cities would still be part of those states, and if there were any problems there, the cities are going to be very dependent upon the countryside because they can't feed themselves. And I think there could be some pressure that could be put on those cities, obviously, to go along. And if they decided to declare themselves free cities within the sovereign state of Alabama or Tennessee, good luck in feeding themselves and getting all the other stuff they needed to survive. So, when you break it down like that, I think that they would not have any choice but to go with the state, and currently we still have the majorities in those states.
Well, let me ask you another question and sort of reconsider the architecture, let's say, of an independent Southern nation. There's been talk, and I think it's pretty scary talk, but also probably very much a possibility given the state of the United States now is becoming more and more multiracial, that there will actually be a balkanization. And if that happens, will state governments even survive? And in that case, would you see a Southern nation, for instance, made up of a geographic area rather than a state-by-state mandate or a state-by-state withdrawal from the Union?
Yeah, Bill, I think that may be a possibility. Certainly the balkanization issue with the demographic problems that we have with the D.C. regime being wedded to the idea of diversity and multiculturalism and all that. The good thing about it is that we are still a majority. The Anglo-Celtic majority is still in place in the South, although it's decreasing year by year. And I think eventually, that's going to be a problem of numbers that we can't overcome unless something happens. But presently, I think that basically that if we could have several states go out and form a Southern Republic, that the demographic problems in those states would take care of themselves in due course, because I think with the policies that would be put in place, you would have a lot of people who, for example, didn't want to work and wanted the state to pay for their upkeep. They would be voting with their feet and getting the hell out of Dodge when they found out that they wouldn't be taken care of anymore. So I think, within the next 5 to 10 years, I think we have a window here demographically, and after that it may start closing. But I think we've got a 5 to 10 year window to do something here, or that balkanization issue that you mentioned might really come into play.
All right, gentlemen, hold up right there. When we continue, we've got a half hour left in the show tonight. We're certainly going to give Dr. Hill more time to share some of his personal anecdotes about the South, but we are going to go directly to the telephones when we come back. We got callers from all over the country lined up to get on the show tonight. We want you to call in as well, 1-866-986-NEWS. Keep calling if you can't get through. We'll get to you, or make a good effort at the very least. James Edwards, Bill Rowland, Dr. Michael Hill will be back for tonight's live installment of the Political Cesspool Radio program right after these words from your sponsors. We'll look forward to talking to you on the phone right after these messages.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages. Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397.
Welcome back to the Political Cesspool, everyone. I'm your host, James Edwards. Bill Rowland, co-hosting with me for the second and third hour of tonight's show. Our featured guest tonight, Dr. Michael Hill, president of the League of the South, DixieNet.org. He's on with us right now. We still have a few things we want to bring to your attention, but we are going to go to the phones, and I'll tell you, we are blessed with a very big, very loyal, very interactive listening audience. That being the case, our phone lines are jammed up there at Liberty News Radio, and we are going to take as many calls as we can, but we are going to ask everyone who we put on the air to quickly ask your question or make your point in a couple of sentences, because we do want to get to as many listeners as we can. We want to be fair to all. So we're going to take calls in rapid succession, and we're going to start. We've already been to Idaho. Let's now go to Don in Pennsylvania. Don, you're on the Political Cesspool.
Yes, sir. Hello. I'm a long-time listener, a first-time caller. You know, for years I've heard this anti-South, anti-Confederate propaganda, and it took me a long time to wake up to this, but I would say it's also anti-white. You know, they hold up the Indians as, you know, these people. They were beat down, but yet the South was beat down. Private property was taken from the South. After that war, the Southern families were terrorized. They had private property stolen from them. And as far as reparations, I just wonder where the Southern family, Southern people's reparations are going to come in.
Thank you for the call. Yeah. Don, thank you so much for the call. Dr. Hill, any mention, we hear about slavery reparations. That's something they try to resuscitate from time to time. And thank you again, Don, especially from Pennsylvania, for such a great pro-South call. Dr. Hill, any reparations forthcoming to people like us?
No, I'm afraid not in this political environment, and I'm not sure that I would want to take their filthy money anyway. I would just like for them to get down on their knees and apologize to us. And then we go our separate ways, but I'm not expecting anything like that to happen, and certainly not reparations. And if reparations means we're victims, the hell with it. I'm not going to play the victim for these people.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Michael Hill, and he certainly speaks for me on that issue. Let's continue to take calls. Again, the call-in number tonight, 1-866-986-NEWS. You can be on the Political Cesspool with James, Bill, and Dr. Michael Hill. Let's go to Reese right here in Memphis. Reese, you're on the line.
How y'all doing this evening?
Doing great.
Okay. I am going to say that the Southern white male is the most manipulated citizen in the United States, and it's not by anybody except for rich white people. The Southern white male is always asked to go to war and die for absolutely nothing in meaningless places around the world. Gas prices, your property rights have been taken, and that was all done by neoconservative whites. So this animosity and angst that you have against minorities or blacks, I mean, it has not benefited you at all, and you need to understand that the rich white man is your worst enemy, and you need to do something about your brother at your own dinner table instead of taking that anger towards people who've done nothing to you, have no understanding of their situation. And why in the world you won't do something about your rich white brother that is tearing your life down is something that's so baffling to us that we see it, but we don't understand why you can't see it.
Well, maybe Bill Rowland can help answer that question, and it is a legitimate concern. Thank you for the call. Bill, your take on Reese's comment.
Well, I agree that we're being manipulated by the people that we've put in office, and I think we are – by the way, Reese, I think we are – far less well represented by the people we put in the office than the people that blacks put in office. But you remember that my anger and my wrath is directed at people who made false and direct attacks on our ancestors. And just like I would never attack your ancestors based on things that they did that were noble and good, we're not going to accept those attacks. We're going to respond
to it.
My whole anger was about comments made by Douglas Wilder and by members of the NAACP who have conducted a 20-year-long campaign against monuments and emblems and representations of the South, which we have just tried to maintain for our own sakes. You know, we don't force them on the North. We don't force them on anybody else. And, yes, that makes us very angry, and we're going to respond with anger. But you're right about being manipulated. Everybody is manipulated by rich people, rich white people, who simply live for themselves, live for power. You're correct about that. But, you know, on the other hand, I wish you would make a call in to a black radio show and say, hey, these attacks on these white Southerners are wrong. You know, we need to convince them that, you know, we support them in their efforts against these rich white or rich people of any color or, let's say, religious persuasion who or ethnic background who are manipulating us and not representing us.
All right, that being said, we're going to go back to the phones in a moment. Keep trying to call in, 1-866-986-NEWS. Want to thank Don and Reese for their calls. Now, gentlemen, Bill, you and Mike were talking about a pretty interesting subject during the middle of that commercial break last time, and want to let you all share that with the audience.
I'm sorry, again. Come again, James.
I was talking about the conversation you and Dr. Hill were having during the commercial break.
Michael, I was going to ask you, which states currently have the strongest secession movement? And
which
either North or South, which one seems to be the closest
movement
to bringing about secession?
You know, oddly enough, it's probably Vermont, because it's a small state, very low population, very homogenous racially and ethnically, and even politically. I mean, most of those people up there are flaming liberals, but and they're mostly white flaming liberals, and they have a lot in common, and they want out of the American empire for some of the same reasons that we do, but a lot of different reasons. So I would say, oddly enough, it might be Vermont. And secondly, I would say some of the Mountain West states, like Montana, for example, are much ahead of any southern state, unfortunately.
Well, we had heard recently, for instance, on Glenn Beck, there was a man from Texas there who was talking about Texas secession and some indication that Governor Perry even supported it. Do you see anything in Texas that's particularly promising?
Well, you know, Texas is kind of an unusual case, Bill, because, you know, obviously there are some demographic issues out there with all the Hispanics. You know, you don't know where they want to go. They may want to leave and go back to Mexico or take Texas back to Mexico. So, I mean, you know, you got a demographic issue there that is pretty unusual compared to the other southern states. But there is a lot of sympathy in Texas for the idea of Texas secession. I'm not sure that very much of it is shared by the governor. I think Governor Perry's an opportunist. But there are quite a few Texas secessionists, and I'm not so sure how that movement is going to go, because I've talked to several people who are either in it or observe it pretty closely, and they've got some issues or problems with it. So about the leadership not actually being from Texas and not actually having the best interest of Texas in mind.
Right. I guess we've got more callers, James, don't we?
Well, we're going to get to that after the next break. I want to remind everyone that the call-in number is 1-866-986-NEWS or 1-866 what a 9867, is that right, Denny? 986-6397, I knew that. Or 1-866-986-NEWS. But before we go back to the phones, Bill, I did want to ask Dr. Hill this. We are, of course, promoting the League of the South. And, Michael, you've got a big conference coming up a little bit later this year that I want to give you the opportunity to plug.
Yeah, we have a conference in Atlanta, Georgia, right in the belly of the southern beast here, on the 8th and 9th of October. We've got some good speakers we're setting up. It's usually a two-day event. It's a lot of fun. People usually learn some things. We're not sure exactly what the theme of this year's conference is going to be, but the past couple of years it's been basically what to do when the empire collapses, and it's continuing to collapse day by day. So it'll probably be some continuation of that, but all the information will be on the website.
And that website, again, dixienet.org. Mike, what other activities, if not officially sanctioned by the national organization, are your members taking part in to celebrate Confederate History Month 2010?
Well, we are having, we usually have it on the 24th, 25th, 26th of April, but this year we couldn't get the park, so we're going to have it on May the 8th, down in Wetumpka, Alabama. We're having a big Confederate Heritage and History Day at Gold Star Park in Wetumpka, Alabama, just north of Montgomery, and some other states are having similar events, either in late April or early May, depending on when they celebrate Confederate Confederate Heritage Day and Confederate Memorial Day, rather. There's several of them.
All right, we'll talk more about that, and when we come back, we're going to find out Michael's favorite Confederate hero, favorite Confederate legend. What story does he think of when he thinks of the brave gallantry of the Confederate soldier? We're going to find out that and take a few more calls when the Political Cesspool concludes right after these words from our sponsors.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
We'll return. We'll return.
Jump in the Political Cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the Political Cesspool, James Edwards.
We are going to take one or two more phone calls before this hour concludes. So if you want to get on the Political Cesspool, we have cleared the lines. They are all available now. 1-866-986-NEWS. This is your last chance, gang, to be on the show this evening with myself, Bill Rowland, and Dr. Michael Hill. You want to call in? And now's your chance. 1-866-986-NEWS. Okay, Dr. Hill, we had a great show with Sam Dixon last week. Every show we have during Confederate History Month is always rousing. And the one question I ask each of our featured guests during this annual April celebration is, your favorite Confederate hero, your favorite Confederate story. Dr. Hill, favorite Confederate hero, who would it be?
Nathan Bedford Forrest.
The classic one, the classic one. And for so many reasons, but tell us yours.
He was a man that I could identify with. He was not an aristocrat. He was not from an aristocratic family. He was from the Mid-South, where I'm from, and he was a common man of the people with very little formal training, and I just liked his style.
We've talked about this every year, Bill, and we'll probably talk about it at more length next week. Nathan Bedford Forrest being, although he was born in Chapel Hill, Tennessee, was, for all intents and purposes, a Memphian. He is, of course, buried here in Memphis with a great monument there, ironically enough, on Union Avenue in downtown. But this was a guy born into poverty, absolute squalor, became a self-made millionaire in the time, which you can imagine what kind of work that would take. After becoming a self-made millionaire, donated much of his riches to outfit the Confederate Army, then, with no military training, enlisted as a private, a soldier of the lowest rank, into an army. I mean, can you imagine a multimillionaire in this day and age enlisting as a grunt in an army? And then, with no military training, become not one of the greatest military geniuses throughout the history of civilization, but in my opinion, the greatest military genius in the history of modern warfare. His tactics are still studied and emulated to this day. That was Nathan Bedford Forrest. And there's so many great stories in between those bookends. I mean, the story of Fallen Timbers, the way what he did at the Battle of Shiloh. We'll talk more about it next week. Nathan Bedford Forrest, though, it's almost as if he were a mythical god. I mean, that's how wondrous his exploits were.
Absolutely.
All right, Dr. Hill, favorite story pertaining to the Confederacy? Is it a battle? Is it some sort of anecdote?
Story about one man's war. His name was Jack Henson from Kentucky. He was an older fella. The Yankees killed his two sons in Kentucky, brutally murdered them. Mr. Henson buried them, calmly went and had himself a first-rate sniper rifle made, took to the woods by himself, and spent the rest of the war killing Yankees by himself.
That is a story that I have to cop to. I have to admit I have never heard before, but I feel good after hearing it. That's something sort of along the line of Mel Gibson's character in The Patriot. I mean, it's something similar to that.
Somebody ought to make a movie about Jack Henson.
Well, maybe you could be him. Maybe you could play his character.
I'm not very much of an actor.
We'll talk to Merlin Miller nonetheless. All right, Bill, one of my favorite stories of the Confederacy is one that I'd like for you to share on my behalf because you can tell it in no more detail than I would. Tell the story of DeWitt Smith Job.
Well, DeWitt Smith Job stands out as I was going to say that my favorite general being Robert E. Lee, but DeWitt Smith Job being my second hero. He was a member of a group that was organized by General Bragg called Coleman Scouts. And what the Coleman Scouts did was to reconnoiter and to spy on Yankees behind enemy lines. And he was actually captured by a vedette of Ohio cavalry and was subsequently tortured to death. He had his eyes gouged out. His tongue was pulled out. He was dragged behind a horse, and eventually, I think he was hanged and then dragged behind a horse to his mother's house, where his body was left. But he refused during that torture to reveal the names of any other Coleman Scouts. And of course, his compatriot in the Coleman Scouts, Sam Davis, is more famous than he is. And his execution, which was carried out with military, under a military, court-martial. But, Sam Davis is more famous because he was hanged by a court-martial, and DeWitt Smith Job was hanged by a bunch of thugs. But, he certainly stands out to me as, the epitome of defiance in the face of a cruel enemy.
And Michael, you know, the history of the war is replete with examples of Northern savagery like that which Bill just described. Never once have I come across an account of Southern treachery that could compare to the torture that D.S. Job was subjected to. And again, we are the ones who, if you rely on the mainstream, so-called mainstream political pundits to tell the story, we are the terrorists, they were the liberators. And, you know, black or white, whatever the issue you want to make the war to be about, it just wasn't that way.
Well, the unfortunate thing here is that a lot of our people believe these lies. That's very unfortunate that our people believe these lies. But, you know, I think there's a reason why our soldiers behaved honorably and admirably as they were gentlemen. Even from the lowest ranks of society, they still were gentlemen in the way they conducted a war as civilized men.
You know, I was going to ask you, Michael, I don't know, and this is for some of our listeners like Reed.
Can you find out what he...
But I don't know of a single atrocity carried out against slaves by Confederate soldiers during the entire war. A systematic atrocity. I'm not saying there weren't, you know, isolated incidents. But clearly, there were systematic atrocities carried out against slaves by Northern troops. I know of cases, for instance, in Oxford, Mississippi in 1863. Sherman's troops in 1864, where these were absolutely deliberate atrocities carried out against unarmed slaves. And I don't know of one that can be attributed to Confederate soldiers.
Yeah, that was very common, in, particularly during Sherman's campaigns in Georgia and South Carolina. I mean, if you read the history of that from firsthand accounts, you're going to see all kind of atrocities committed not only against white Southerners, but slaves as well. And thank goodness we have the record of the time, or, you know, that would be covered up as well. But it's there for people who want to find it.
Gentlemen, we are coming near the end of this show tonight. I tell you, it always goes by far too quickly. We do have some callers on the line. I don't know If we have about a minute left, I want to remind everyone to check out the League of the South website, dixienet.org. Read more about Michael Hill. Of course, our website, thepoliticalcesspool.org. We have 30 seconds to go. Let's quickly take a comment, and I mean a sentence, from Dave in Chicago. Dave, you're on the air.
Okay, hi, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going fine, thank you. I just wanted to follow up real quick. There was a caller named Reese who had talked about how Southern whites are manipulated, and that's true, but I think it's, you know, it's poor whites, poor and lower middle class whites, because they're the first ones that have to fight the wars for this country. It's really not the blacks. It's always the poor whites. And I think the battlefield casualties bear that out. But the larger issue is that poor and lower middle class whites, they're really fighting a two-front war right now. They have to contend with blacks and Mexicans who hate their guts just because they're whites. And then at the same time, you know, the more affluent whites or the rich whites, the neoconservatives, you know, aren't there to protect them or advocate for them. So in effect, they have no advocates at the state or national level looking out for their interests. They've been left to twist in the wind.
Dave, I want to thank you for that call. I wish we had more time to examine it a little further, but I got to tell you, there's a lot of truth, unfortunately, in what you just shared with us, and I want to thank you for calling in from Chicago this evening with those thoughts, and thank you for being a listener of our program. Let us know what more we can do to serve you, and we hope to hear from you maybe next week. That being said, we're out of time. For Bill Rowland, Winston Smith, Eddie the Bombardier Miller, and Keith Alexander, I am James Edwards on behalf of the Political Cesspool. Thanks to Dr. Michael Hill for being our guest this evening. Check him out at dixienet.org, and we'll see you next Saturday, everybody. Good night, and God bless you.
Joining us tonight in the Political Cesspool. To learn more about us or to make a donation to keep this program on the air, go to www.thepoliticalcesspool.org.